Phil Donahue. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented, I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me, I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied, he demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail, I lands on his head. He flips his head, I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea, I start singing South to the Border, Down Mexico Way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull, he collapses. A cheer goes up, I'm saved, and the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Thank you, Jimmy. It's the last weekend of February, and whoever determines what weather will be has said, speaking for the month of February, said, we're going to make it miserable the last 2 days for you in New York City. It's been a horrendous month weather-wise. Snow, pandemic, that's not weather, but it's all related, is it not? Making us miserable. So I took my morning walk, only went about 8 blocks today, talked with a few dogs along the way. In and out of the puddles. I can't wait till February is over. Well, the highlight of this weekend is the conservatives gathering for a maskless convention in Orlando, Florida. Donnie's going to talk to them tomorrow night. A whole bunch of Republican House representatives said they couldn't be in for the hearings or the vote on the stimulus package because of health, not knowing that there will be cameras in Florida and they were discovered down there. Avoiding their responsibility as elected officials, going down for the Trump rally. The little senator from Missouri got up and chattered away yesterday, but it's all about Donnie. It's not about Cruz. It's not about him. It's Donnie time. The House did pass the stimulus package. Kevin McCarthy, House Minority Leader, Republican, said the swamp is back. Since he's a crocodile, he certainly should feel comfortable if there's any indication of a swamp. Well, there's a nice, cheerful political start, isn't it? I watched the hearings in great part this week, the January 6th, the hearings that they had in Congress about what happened, the insurrection, the resurrection, if you will. I have a basic question. We have been told over and over again that on the internet and on the anti-social media, it was reported for weeks what was being planned. They announced they were coming. It wasn't a secret. Thousands arrived a couple of days early. There were several arrests. And yet, it didn't look anything like the day when the Black Lives Matter, when we saw that what looked like General Patton's army on the steps of the Capitol prepared to respond to anything. 400 people were arrested during the Black Lives Matter day. 16 were arrested on January 6th. When you keep hearing about 100 have been arrested since, that's because they have been recognized on the replaying of the tapes and the selfies that they were all taking. But the question that I would ask is, of all the law enforcement people who were those that were there, understaffed, overwhelmed, mauled and battered, did anyone give the orders to say to the National Guard or for any of the support troops to stay back? Would that have come from the AG's office, the Attorney General's office, or the Defense Department, or from the White House? Did anyone say, stay back? Were there orders? Because when they reported, the police officers and the officials of law enforcement at the hearings kept saying they were overwhelmed. How does that line up with the fact that we have been told over and over again that it was warned, that if our intelligence community, whatever that is, wherever that is, can detect cyber attacks from Iran, China, and Russia, can't they report internet outbursts here in the 50 states? I think there's a piece missing, and I don't know why that question's not being asked. At those hearings, Ron Johnson, Republican senator from Wisconsin, established the fact that he's a total idiot. He said that many in the crowd, he described it. It sounded like it was a PTA Sunday picnic outing. And he brought up the anti-fascist group that Trump keeps identifying, and that a few rotten apples climbed. I saw those were a lot of rotten apples climbing the walls, patrolling the halls of Congress. That wasn't a few. That was a lot that got in, breaking windows and crawling through. And he minimized it. Ted Cruz was there. I think he was in the House, in the Senate hearings. Why wasn't he quarantined for 2 weeks, having taken his trip to Cancun? Oh, there are so many questions that I have to ask. And I have to make an announcement. This is an official announcement. I am not running for mayor. I am one of four New Yorkers who have made that official announcement that they are not running for mayor. It's open to everyone else. We play music on Saturday mornings to sort of mollify you as we rant and rave about the state of the nation. What better person to celebrate with us on this last February Saturday than Judy Garland with a Yip Harburg Burt Lane song? Judy, take it away.
Look at you, and suddenly something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. You and your glance make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night, blazing their light, can't hold a candle to your razzle-dazzle. You got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride.
One of the Gum Sisters. Judy was a Gum Sister, part of a trio discovered with that extraordinary voice, and the rest is history. After Tiger's accident on, what was it, Wednesday or Thursday, and certainly captured the attention of not only the sports world, Tiger transcends the sports world. He's known, as Bob Costas said, identifying that always identified anonymous little old lady in Iowa. She's always the subject of validating, it's not validating. The little old lady in Iowa is always used as an example of how widespread anything or someone is. And he suggested that Tiger was not only known to his golf and sport fans, but transcended the sports world for many reasons. I may also add that Bob, who's always a nice-looking young reporter and still has a clarity, and his essays are wonderful, looks like he had a little work done on his face. I don't mean to be unpleasant or catty, but there's sort of a Dorian Gray look about him now. I sort of close my eyes and listen because he's rather insightful. And I wanted to comment on what he said on CNN. After talking about the specifics of Tiger, and explaining why he was known to the little old lady in Iowa, whoever she is, wherever she is, they're usually in Dubuque. I think it was Harold Ross of the New Yorker who said, "We want to be understood by the little old lady in Dubuque." She has gotten an awful lot of attention. Anyway, Costas talked about that there are certain athletes that transcend the sports world. He cited Tiger, Tom Brady, Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan. I would throw in Derek Jeter. And his point was that they were, for whatever reasons, not all, their excellence, obviously, in their games, that they were excellent, but non-sports fans knew them as well. And he said it's because of the way they look. He said if Muhammad Ali looked like Leon Spinks, he wouldn't have had the popularity. He said there's a certain look. I wouldn't call it conventionally handsome, although I guess Tom Brady could be thrown as that Hollywood look. Michael does somewhat. But there is something appealing in their physical presence that makes non-sports fans take notice of them, if This is his theory. And I was fascinated by it because I always have put forth the notion that quarterbacks, if you look at the quarterbacks on professional football team, they're usually a little taller than most other backs and better looking. And it started in about the third or fourth grade that the kid, the boy who was the best looking boy in the class and a good athlete was always the leader. You, whether it's sports or not, you'd say, where's Joey and the guys? Or you go to the next school and they say, where's Billy and the guys? And those were always the, and of course we always repeat all through life, we're reliving high school values, mores, pecking order, who were the popular kids? And the quarterback was always the popular guy. And he was Tom Brady. He was Russell Wilson. Always great looking, good for commercials on television. If you Allstate is almost all quarterbacks. It's I don't know if I would call it homoerotic, but it's certainly a physical attractiveness that makes boys at an early age leaders. That doesn't mean all good looking boys become leaders or that all good athletes are good looking. But there is enough of a trend for Margaret Mead to do a study. And it certainly is true in the case of Tiger Woods, Tom Brady, Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, and I throw in Derek Jeter. And you may have your own athletes. Just think of when you went to high school. Who was the boy? Alan Morse, Teaneck High School. He'd strut down the hall and all the girls would swoon and all the boys would say, God, if I look like that, I'd have all the girls. He was the captain of the basketball team. He was 6'3". He was blonde and blue-eyed. He fit the bill. That doesn't mean everybody has to be blonde and blue-eyed to be attractive. Russell Wilson is African-American and is stunning looking and has the most beautiful wife. She's one of the modern singers whose names always elude me, but she's as gorgeous as he is. But it's an interesting theory about how the looks in early second, third, fourth grade shape the kid who becomes the junior high school and the high school quarterback. And of course, the best of the lot end up in college, and then the best of that lot go pro. His smile, his charisma, and of course, his infidelities, which were highlighted. I don't know why when somebody has a car accident, they have to go over all of that, but that was in all the news accounts. But it's an interesting theory. I'm sure there are at least 14 people listening who think I'm absolutely full of it and don't agree, and they will let me know in no uncertain terms. But I think it's worth discussing, don't you? Not the most important issue of the day, but an interesting look at our psyches as we are children growing up. And I am convinced more than ever that for those of us who went, especially those of us who went to suburban high schools, but maybe in large metropolitan high schools as well, we are reliving the pecking order, the who's popular, who's the nerd, who's the outcast, who's the brain, who fits in and who doesn't fit in. It's a theory. And Smokey Robinson and the Miracles are singers. And here's Smokey with one of the big hits that he and the Miracles had. He co-wrote this with Al Cleveland. And if you're over 40, you know it the minute you hear the first note. Smokey, the Miracles. And a taste of honey's worse than none at all. Oh,
Mike Smoke, nice to have you aboard here on Saturday morning. Did I say that my name is David Rothenberg, the program is any Saturday? If I didn't, it is. And even if I did, it is. Douglas Turner Ward passed away this week at the age of 90. I was in awe of him. He was 90 years old when he passed, had a good, long, rich life. The founder, the spirit behind the Negro Ensemble Company, one of the very important theatrical companies that surfaced in the 60s. And so many extraordinary artists came through the Negro Ensemble Company, not the least of whom was Denzel Washington. I had my office working in the theater was at 1501 Broadway, 46th Street. You had to go behind the box office of the Victoria Theater, took the terrible elevator that was often not working to the sixth floor. And there was a suite there. And I had one office, and the next office was Dorothy Ullum and Jerry Crone, who were the business managers, and it be there for the Negro Ensemble Company. And it, in fact, became the headquarters for the NEC. And so I was, and we were in, and we shared everything together. I'm going out for coffee. Do you want anything? Heads sticking there, peeking into my office. So we were supportive of each other. And as the Fortune Society began, they were all champions of us. And as the NEC was growing, all of us went to all their plays. I was much more comfortable with the actors. Bobby, known as Robert Dean Hooks, his little boy, Kevin, ended up as the kid in Sounder and then a important actor and director, and Moses Gunn. We were pals. I was in awe of, maybe because he was a playwright or because of the way he carried himself, of Douglas Turner Ward, but I was respectful and admired him. And he wrote one of the funniest plays I've ever seen called Day of Absence. It's a long one act. I thought I was going to split. It takes place in a southern town, and all the black people have disappeared. Everybody in the cast is African-American with white face, which... And the black people in town have all disappeared, and the town is in a tizzy. Nobody knows who's going to, the women don't know who's going to take care of their kids. The mayor stands up and makes a speech and says, yells to his assistant, I haven't emptied the garbage. It's waiting for you, Rufus. Come back. It is such a parody, so funny. I remember Barbara Ann Teer played the switchboard operator. Oh, it was a scream. Just a scream. So when I read of Douglas's passing, I had memories of those creative days in which I was a very close observer. Also, Errol Lewis, who's hosts the New York One at 7 o'clock, and is an extremely insightful CNN commentator. Among the best, I may add, had a beautiful column this week about his father had passed away, Edward Lewis. I did not know he had died, but I had met Edward Lewis, who came to many BAI and Fortune Society functions and always introduced me and said, Mr. Rothenberg, I'm Edward Lewis. Earl is my son, and I enjoy your program. And he was a BAI supporter. And when you... I saw Errol overnight on CNN, his insight onto what's happening politically, both with the conservative conference down in Orlando and the bill that's being that was passed by the House. He's as sharp and as comfortable with who he is. And I could see the great influence in that kind man, Errol's dad, Edward Lewis, who introduced himself to me on so many different occasions. I remember he was at the Castle for a performance of the play The Castle. And we chatted at length afterwards. And I thought, what a nice guy. I didn't know that he was a retired cop, which Errol had reported in this op-ed piece in the Daily News on Thursday. Look for him on CNN or on New York One if you get it. His commentary, you know why he's so good? He clarifies issues for me. I find that some of the commentators obscure the issues, and I'm more baffled than I was before they talked. He clarifies it and goes a little bit deeper. I admire him greatly, Errol Lewis. All right, pencil and paper time, class. It's WBAI. The contest, we have another week. It will conclude next. The winners will be announced next Saturday and Monday. You know, I'm on Mondays at 10 as well as Saturdays. The contest, I'm leaning over. The contest, which we do occasionally now, we used to do it all the time. Now it's maybe once a month, is for an opportunity for us to have some fun with each other. And the contest now is, there's a documentary movie being made about what happened in America between Election Day and January 6th. The documentary is made and they want to title it. And they've come to us at BAI and they say they need a title that's ripe, that has a BAI sensibility, an irony, a humor, or a stunning kind of disclosure in the title. And I gave some examples, No Time for Comedy, A Funny Thing Happened to Me on the Way to the Capitol, or The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and the Bad, and the Ugly, and the Bad, and the Ugly. So you can still submit a closing. We'll have the contest until next Friday around noon, because I need time to assemble and go through it. We've got dozens and dozens and dozens of participants so far. If you can make three, you can submit three titles. You have to give your first and last name class. Now take notes on this, because lots of people just sign it Joe or have a email address that says Cyrus 603. I have to know your name and where you come from. Are you from one of the five boroughs? Are you from Thornton, Colorado, or Ocala, Florida, as some of our entrants have been, or Pittsburgh? So you will submit it to me. You'll send it to me by email at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Have you written that down? Do you have the pencil in your hand? Or pen? Pen's all right, class. Remember inkwells? Have I asked you that before? Are you old enough to remember inkwells? They had a little scratchy pen, and the teacher told us to pick up our pens and stick it in the inkwell with a little hole in the desk. All right, so drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. You can make three submissions on your mark, get, set, go. First and last name class, and remember, neatness counts. That was another one in class. Neatness counts. That was very big. All right. Now, the other thing for pencil and paper, we're listener sponsored. Did you ever hear us mention that? We raise money and you're the source of the money. And so we do different things that we have what is called premiums, and we offer it. We dangle it like a carrot and hope that you will be intrigued enough to support us with money. We think you should support us because we're an important, we're little and we're noisy, but we add something to the spectrum, if you will. There are certain programs that I cannot live without, Law and Disorder on Mondays. And many of us listen to Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez for Democracy Now! And get a perspective on the news that we don't get elsewhere. Tom Robbins' new program on Mondays at 5 o'clock. He, an outstanding investigative reporter, giving a journalist's perspective on stories, usually digging deeper than what you hear on most news programs. I love Malachi and John with the Irish program on Sundays. There's lots. So that's why we want you to support us. I'm going to tell you, I did mention it last week. This is a premium of 8 DVDs, which means 8 movies and 1 CD. And it's about the criminal justice system. And each movie, they're really quite extraordinary pictures. And even if it might be of interest to you as an individual, or you might be belong to a school or a library, an organization that would want a program, and this is the start for something in post pandemic or maybe during the pandemic. One of the movies is Cindy Firestone's Attica, which is a documentary that is important to me. It was the first and the definitive movie about that great historic prison uprising. There's a documentary with Bryan Stevenson, who was my choice to be the next president of the United States, but what do I know? He is as smart and as clear and as inspiring a man that lives in America today. Did you see the movie about him? I think did Michael Jordan play him? I think so. Michael Jordan, the actor, not the basketball player. There's one of the movies is about the Angola Three Panthers who were locked in because of their politics, not because of what they did on the streets. There's one about, it's called Slavery with another name, about how the black population and through the drug laws, it's a way of stripping people of their vote, lock them up, give them a charge, get them out of the get them out off the streets, and then you have the state legislature bar them from voting forever, and it's a way of keeping black people from voting. It's a movie called Slavery by Another Name. Powerful stuff. And then there's one on the closing of Rikers Island. Well, all of those movies, eight of them, for $125 and one CD. That's something you just listened to. If you are interested, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com and leave your phone number and I'll call you. The other thing we have is last week we had one of my favorite guests of all time. Her name is Lola St. Veal, but her book is authored by Marie Arnold. She was an intern working with me, coming in every Saturday morning, taking calls on the phone. I thought a young girl out of Haiti, who I thought was bright and funny, and I knew she was going to do something special. And she has written a book, and I love the book. And she was our guest last week. It's called The Year I Flew Away. It's about a young girl who comes from Haiti to Brooklyn. Her family has sent her here to live with other relatives. It's a novel, but it's also Lola's story. And it's about how it's a fantasy. It's about how she makes a deal with the devil to make it here, but has to give up her Haitian heritage in order to find popularity. High school, there you go again. And how she longs to get her Haitian heritage back. It's a beautiful story. If you have a young person who you want to give a gift to, I couldn't think of a better one. If you just want to have a good book to read, a book, and I said it, you know, it's labeled as a young person's book in the same way Alice in Wonderland, Gulliver's Travel, or Wizard of Oz might be. It's called The Year I Flew Away. And for $50, you'll support us. And somebody, a couple of people bought two or three copies too, for birthday gifts that they hold for young women that they know. And there's no reason why a young boy can't wait. Listen, I'm an Altacaca and I'm not Asian and I loved it. So email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. All right. Now we're going to do, should we play? It's this. I'm David Rothenberg. The show's any Saturday. WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I don't think that the Biden administration will arrest me if I don't do it correctly. Why don't we, should I do Odetta? Sean, why don't we play Odetta and then I'll do my weekly essay out on a limb. Okay, so Odetta, who used to be a listener to this program, I'll tell you about that afterwards. Odetta.
House from my bedroom down home to the ground. And it's blues everywhere, 'cause my good man has left this town. Sweet man has gone. There's blues in my mailbox, 'cause I can't get no mail. There's blues in my mailbox, 'cause I can't get no mail. There's blues in my bread box, 'cause my bread is gone stale.
Long-time listeners have heard this story, but I don't mind telling it over and over again. One Saturday morning after the program, I received a phone call. David Rothenberg, yes, long-time listener, enjoyed your show. Hi, how are you? What's your name? Odetta. Oh, just like the singer. Not only like the singer. No kidding. Yeah. Love your show. Love the music you play. Love your commentary. Thank you. I kind of like your music, too. Why don't we get together? So we met for coffee and began a friendship that I treasured. She even came at my request. She did a benefit for BAI, filled up the community church down on 35th and Park, made a lot of money for WBAI. Back in the day, we did that sort of thing. She passed away a few years ago and is missed greatly. I got this All right, pencil and paper out again, class. I just got this emergency email. Mumia Abu-Jamal has COVID. Emergency in-person action today in Philly, and a massive telephone jam call on Monday to the prison, the governor and the Philly's DA's office. I've been listening to Mumia for years, and I heard him. I don't know if it was on Democracy Now. Heard him a few months ago. I am in awe. All of those years, with all of the questions about the case itself and the punishment he has received, the clarity, the intelligence, the compassion of this man, and we have him wasting away in a gulag. And now he has COVID. On Monday, March 1st, 21, shut him down. Call all three numbers all day long to demand immediate hospital examination and medical care by non-prison doctors and staff. The Office of Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, 717-787-2500. The Office of Mahaney Prison Superintendent Bernadette Mason, 570-773-2158. I call that one last. Superintendents of prisons are the last one that can make decisions at this level. Office of Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner, 215-686-8000. I have another plan. The Commissioner of Corrections from Pennsylvania, who seemed quite progressive for the field, came and visited the castle and was impressed enough. This is way before the pandemic, that he was sending different staff people from the Pennsylvania Department of Correction. I'm going to find out his number and call his office, because that's where the decision might be made. It's rather a chilling reality. And to add on to this, is from the Marshall Project. New COVID-19 cases behind bars continue to drop as some prisoner staffs are vaccinated. New cases among prisoners rose about 1% last week. More than 383,000 prisoners have tested positive for the coronavirus since last March. At least 2,445 have died. 189 prison employees have died. And what's never in these figures is the correction officers going home and back into their community, what they've brought with the virus. It's to be noted, please. Wow. It doesn't say what the extent of whether Mumia just was positive, but he's up there in years, and so there should be concern if he's positive. All right, it's 8:45, and I'm going to do Out on a Limb now, after I have some water. Many of us gave a collective sigh of relief when there was a changing of the guard in the White House on January 21st. Reluctant and insidious as was the departing president, you know, the blonde buffalo, it's clear that Joe Biden's task is mountainous. Not only specific legislation that progressives are advocating, but also to lessen the possibility of another fascist returning to the Oval Office. President Biden has to convince a substantial number of the 74 million Trump voters that the country can respond to their concerns. Obviously, the descendants of the Kallikaks and the Jukes are beyond reaching. But I am sure that there's sufficient number of Trump voters who did not support the violence or the invasion of the Capitol and or want a civil war. Most folks, most people, left, right, and center, just want to get through the day, unbothered, pay their rent, have food on the table, and be left alone. That's my assumption. The insurrectionists, the wall climbers, are a formidable number. But their devotion to Trump is misguided, and they will discuss as he faces court battles that their concerns are not his. My concern is not the lingering influence of Trump, but that the temperature could produce a more lethal aspirant for the crown, less obvious than the egocentricity and pettiness of Trump. That is Biden's major assignment, Stimulus package a must. Pandemic coordination essential. Climate change and immigration legislation to gain attention and support. But plain talk, as he has done, to neuter the misinformation and rage left over by the blubbermouth of recent vintage. Pollsters tell us that more than half the people who voted for Trump still think the election was stolen. On the other hand, immediately after the January 6th uprising, 150,000 voters signed out of the Republican Party. That was not an organized campaign like the well-choreographed January 6th outburst, or like the millions who took to the streets on that November Saturday when Biden clinched Georgia and the presidency. Remember that day around the nation, there was literally dancing in the streets. The media keeps reporting of Trump's base, but the celebrants on that day were far greater in number than the January 6th thugs. That's Joe Biden's base, those street dancers who want the new president to lead us out of the darkness that was being inflicted on America. Biden lacks the color or the charisma that we would hope for, but maybe that's just what America needs after the blonde buffalo hoodwinked a reasonable number of Americans for 4 years. Let's do some math. 74 million did vote for an incompetent, pathological liar in 2020. 10,000 gathered at the Capitol on January 6th, attempting to violently overthrow the government. How many of the 74 million approved of the violence? We can guess that 115,000 were not on board because they left the GOP. But before I get too nerdy with arithmetical observations, what else do we know? Almost all of the 74 million were white, with a few Floridian Hispanics and Kanye West soiling the mix. We're also aware that many of the 74 million voted against their own best economic interests, white men who will benefit from a $15 minimum and the stimulus package, hints of socialism about which they have been warned. The money merchants have convinced single-issue enthusiasts that the only place they belong is with the GOP and Trump, if he is the party's standard bearer. Most evangelicals have deified Trump, adulterous and rape charges notwithstanding. And then there are the conspiracy advocates. 9/11 was an inside job. Sandy Hook didn't happen. Vaccines and masks are the enemy. And those lost shivering puppies on SPCA TV ads are trained dogs. That's the base. Logic, reason, and truth, not a factor. The Democrats and Biden's goal is to locate 10 or 15 million of those 2020 Trump 74 million voters and demonstrate that transparency and decency can guide a political agenda for them, for their best interest, to protect the nation from a future dictator. Because since the first slave ships landed on these shores centuries ago, that's been our reality, a contradiction to the noble words authored by the creators of the Constitution. Patriots, enthusiasts, or originalists, if you will, fail to recall or remind us that our original voters were restricted to white males who were property owners. Excluded were all blacks, all women, and white men who didn't own property. That last group, white men, didn't own property, have been powerless historically. And there they were, climbing the walls of the Capitol on January 6th for a billionaire, the only way they knew how to be heard. Trump told them to flex their muscles, a way to achieve power. But then he went in another direction, got into his limo as they did his dirty work for him, mouthing his false claims, making his big lie theirs. He told them on January 6th, go forward, and I'll be going with you. And then he jumped into the limo. And that's one story of America, at least half the story. The other half is you and me and how we will endure and navigate through this manufactured morass. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. And the next voice you'll hear will be Mel Torme.
pessimist because I've been kissed by lovely you. What can it be that suddenly came over me? What is this thing called love? This funny thing called love. Is there anybody who can solve this mystery? Tell me, why should it make a fool of me?
My heart and threw it away.
And that's why I ask the Lord in heaven above, what is this thing called love? It's hard to bear, looked everywhere. Everyone under the sun, they turn away each time I say, what is this thing called love?
I wonder who that support group was. They were all those backup singers in the day, the Mellotones and the Four Whatevers. That was Mel Torme. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with Mitchell James Kaplan, who's written a book that I think he wrote just for me. That's how much I enjoyed it. But as we introduce him, we're going to play something from Broadway. Elton John's and Tim Rice's did an adaptation of Aida. Here's Alan Pascal and Tony Award winner Heather Hadley singing Elaborate Lives from that. And then we'll be talking with Michael James Kaplan about his book Rhapsody.
We all lead such elaborate lives. Wild ambitions in our sights. How an affair of the heart survives days apart and hurried nights. Seems quite unbelievable to me. I don't want to live like that. Seems quite unbelievable to me. I don't want to love like that. I just want our time to be slow and gentler, wiser, free. We all live in extravagant times, playing games we can't unintended emotional crimes. Take some out, take others in. I'm so tired of all we're going through. I don't want to live like that. I'm so tired of all we're going through. I don't wanna love like that. I just wanna be with you now and forever. Peaceful, true. This may not be the moment. choices tear us apart. I don't want to love like that. I just want to touch your heart. May this confession be
beautiful. Adam Pascal and Heather Hadley from Tim Rice and Elton John's Broadway version of Aida. I'm David Rothenberg. The program's any Saturday in a rainy New York City on February 27th. WBAI-FM 99.5 and listener-sponsored radio. And we're joined by Michael James Kaplan. Thank you for joining us. From where? Virginia, are you not?
Yes, I'm in. It's rainy here also, Roanoke, Virginia.
We're being punished. This is the year of the punishment. It's February, as you got to let go. I said before you joined us that when I read Rhapsody after about the 10th pages, I said, he wrote this book for me. It's everything I want in a novel. And it is a novel, but it's about real people, which and people who I would hear whispered about in the theater. And I want to tell you that your central figure, Kay Swift, I looked for old timers and I asked about six or seven people as I was reading the book. I'd call them and say, do you know who Kay Swift was? And every one of them said, oh yeah, she had the affair with George Gershwin. And I thought, isn't that interesting? This was the woman who was the first woman who composed a Broadway musical in the history of Broadway. And isn't that interesting, the feedback?
Yes, I mean, not just composed a Broadway musical, of course. Also wrote a ballet for George Balanchine, and her Broadway musical was a hit, and produced, obviously, as you know, some classic tunes, Fine and Dandy, Can This Be Love, etc. So, no, she was she became the principal songwriter for the Rockettes and really helped create that whole scene. So I would say that she was a very important person in the history of Broadway and music. But her relationship with George Gershwin was one of the central components of her, I would say, coming into her own as a human being, as a person, as a woman, and as composer. And by the way, the influence was mutual. She had a great effect on him in all those ways, on him as a person and on him as a musician. And that's what I wanted to show. It's one of the things I wanted to show in this book was, although it was a complicated love affair, complicated situation for them and for Kay's husband, James Warburg, It was ultimately redeeming through the music for both of them and transformative. And it wasn't a case of, I didn't want to write the book that everyone writes these days, which is the woman behind the man or the man behind the woman or anything like that. I wanted to show that a relationship can be complex, can be mutually beneficial with a lot of difficulties built in, and life is so much richer than those kinds of schematic ways of looking at it. So, yeah,
What attracted you to her story? Because way before your time, and apparently, when I talk to people, does not have a legacy that's generally known. And once we start probing through your book, which is, and we'll talk about what's fiction and what's real in there. What made you aware of her and then see that there was a story, and I'm going to talk about the movie. I've already cast it. What attracted you to the story and what did you know about her growing up, if anything? And where did you see you become aware of the fact that this is Broadway drama of the first magnitude?
Well, I had some recordings that had songs of hers. There's a very, very popular recording with Ella and Louis Armstrong singing Can't We Be Friends? And it's a beguiling tune with it spans a wide range of notes, and it's got a lot of blues notes in it. And she's playing a lot with Gershwin ideas in it, but also with very much grounded in her own kind of classical background. And so I was aware of her, certainly, and I think people who listen to jazz are aware of her hit tunes. Maybe not all of them, but I came to the book actually through Gershwin, and it happened I was having breakfast, well, a cup of coffee, that's my breakfast, about four cups of coffee, at early in the morning, about 4 a.m, and in my dining room, I had the CD player on with about 300 discs in the carousel. My father had died a couple years earlier, and the Rhapsody in Blue came on, and I started crying. And I saw my father standing in the family room of our house where I grew up in Los Angeles, playing the clarinet with that opening wail, which I call a klezmer wail, at the beginning of Rhapsody in Blue. And he had died a couple years earlier, as I just mentioned, and he and everything he had lived through came back to me through music, and I just knew that was the start of my next novel. That was maybe the focal piece of my next novel. So I started reading books about Gershwin, and I didn't know beforehand how complicated this relationship was, and the fact that the Warburg banking family was a big component of this scene added a complexity to it and a richness to it and a historical richness to it that I love. And unfortunately, I have a tendency to cram everything I possibly can into each of my novels. So they abound in, and people, some people don't like this, other people love it, but they abound in references to the social milieu and the music of the time and what was happening in society as filtered through the imaginations of the protagonists. And so there's a love triangle in there of sorts, but an unusual one. And it just grew. It just grew. I kept reading more books, and then the characters just started kind of coming alive for me. And I found Kay's dramatic arc so interesting because she starts out in this kind of rigid, puritanical, whatever, household. And she's classically trained. She's brilliant. She's really a musical prodigy, becomes the first star of the Institute of Musical Art, which later is going to become Juilliard School of Music, and and she marries into this banking family, and she's still unhappy, and then she discovers Broadway. Jazz.
But let me ask you, we're talking to Mitchell James Kaplan. She was not of the manor born. She came from a middle-class family. And the Warburgs were, I guess, like the American version of the Rothschilds and the Lehmans. And she marries a Warburg and suddenly is from the townhouse school of New York living.
And I think that has something to do with what happens between her and George, because she marries into what is effectively a kind of European aristocracy.
Yes.
And she herself possesses a tremendous kind of aristocratic education, really, in music, and I would say personality also. But there's a part of her that's more simple, that appreciates, the groundedness of a person like George Gershwin, who grew up on the Lower East Side and in Harlem and in Brooklyn. His family was moving between lower middle class and middle class through his whole childhood, kind of a self-taught pianist, really, although he did take lessons with a variety of different people. He's almost the opposite of Kay in some ways, in that he's of a specific cultural heritage that's very different from hers, but they both come. They both, I think, the aristocracy and the traditions, particularly the marital traditions within aristocracy in Europe, were something very foreign for Kay.
I couldn't get a handle on Warburg's talent, though. Was it because he was so wealthy that the doors were open to him? He wrote lyrics for her. Was he mediocre, yeah, or was there a real talent there?
Oh boy, that's a loaded question. I think I tried to show in my book that in the beginning he's this Harvard-educated, lofty kind of kid who hasn't really discovered his talent, and so he's writing poems in the idiom of the period that has already elapsed. You know, late 19th century romantic Tennyson, Wordsworth, that kind of thing. He's kind of imitating them. He doesn't come into his own until Kay influences him after she's caught the jazz bug and the have fun with it bug, and he starts writing playful lyrics, and then she's amazed. Hey, he can do this. And does he have talent? I think he had talent. Yes, I think he had. I think "Can't We Be Friends" is a nice lyric. I'm not going to say it's.
He also was an early advocate, at least wasn't, I don't think, how popular in the 20s, of an open marriage, because it was, he seemed to be quite aware of her discovery and sharing the bed with George Gershwin, and he had his own, mistresses.
You know, I lived in France for 7 years, and my first 2 years in France, I lived with a very powerful political family. I was their au pair, if you know what that means. Just someone who, basically, they had a cook and they had a chauffeur and they had houses all over the place, and they lived a very, very rarefied, privileged life. So all I had to do was have breakfast with the kids and speak English. That was my job. And then I got their leftover, you know, fancy dinners with fancy wines. But anyway, I got a peek into how that class lives in Europe, and it's the cliches are true. Open marriage is absolutely par for the course in the upper set in Europe, and so Warburg comes from that. And even though they're from a Jewish background, they're very much part of the European upper set in terms of upper class set in terms of the mentality. And he's bringing that into New York in the 1920s when people are exploding with experimental ideas and rejecting prohibition and embracing kind of what we would call today civil rights, and in particular through music. And so Warburg, with these notions, there is a clash at first with Kay, who comes from, as I said, a more of a puritanical background. In those milieu, from what I've seen, you know, the attitude is, you know, you do what you do, I'll do what I do, and we just kind of...
Fascinating. We think of it as a whole different era. You know, it's interesting. Then she meets George, and that's what I found so fascinating, that Gershwin, who was the most successful, talk about success on Broadway and music and theater... Yeah. And he's living in this building on 103rd Street, his mother and father on one floor, brother Ira with his wife on another. And he has a little flat on the third floor. None of the splendor that you would associate, the townhouses that the great artists were living in.
That also is a part of the story. It's his growth. He finally moves out of basically living with his parents.
She's the reason. It sounds like she said, get thee to your own place.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and George's mother was very domineering and tough and didn't particularly like the fact that he was involved with a non-Jewish woman. And so, I wouldn't say he was... He was very much aware, of course, and loved all the attention. But up until the latter third of his life or quarter of his life, he was living very freely, but he wasn't ostentatious.
Well, while the focus is on Kay, the interest in George is so great, because I got the feeling he really wasn't comfortable with all the extras that go with talent, the fame, and he went to Hollywood And yeah, his first yeah. his first movie was not successful. Then later with Fred and Ginger, he did all those wonderful yeah. the first few of those, yeah. I guess, Swing yeah. Time. But he that made him an international celebrity, and yet he was he had the headaches that he always had. He never did yeah. marry, did he? Kay was the love of his yeah. life.
Yes, I would say Kay was the person who follows him through that the latter part of his life of his short
although you
life.
Do tell us that he had a little thing with Paulette Goddard, and why not? She was
yeah,
adorable.
No, he did. she was also a tough person. She wasn't about to, you know, fall in love with him and marry him. That wasn't going to happen. She was involved with Charlie Chaplin.
Yes.
But they did. Gershwin was not particularly interested in monogamy until toward the end. What I write at the, I got an email from a woman who's a pianist who lives in Los Angeles, and then she wanted to talk to me. And we spoke on the phone after she read my book, and her main question for me was, did that call really happen where George tells Kay he's ready to settle down? That meant so much to her. And I told her, it's credible. It's credible because, first of all, Kay says that that's where they were going, that George was moving toward that. And, you know, she's the sole witness, but I believe her. I think he was kind of beat, you know, after the box office failure relative terms, the box office failure of Porgy and Bess. And he didn't.
That's a surprise, too, that Porgy and Bess was not a hit at the beginning.
Right. It wasn't a hit during his lifetime. I mean, it was a by George.
He put up all the money for it. Nobody wanted to produce it.
Yeah. Well, he had problems. You know, the Metropolitan Opera would have done it if he had been okay with the idea of it being done in blackface.
Isn't that something? They did that. I did not know that no blacks were ever on the stage in the Metropolitan at that time. Probably not in the house either.
Not,
extraordinary.
Well, certainly not on the stage, and I think not in the house, and not in Carnegie Hall either, and you know, not in a lot of the white venues. So again, this is, you know, that whole what we were talking about, aristocracy and kind of folk traditions and high art and popular art, they were kept rigidly separate. And if you think of black music from, let's say, the South, from Harlem, et cetera, as being a folk tradition, you can look at it that way in kind of a socioeconomic way, or that the white opera meant something in terms of belonging to a certain class, and they didn't want anything that didn't belong to that class.
But you
and by that I mean, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I said by that I mean, by class I don't just mean how much money people have. I mean what the cultural references are. Is it a reference to the European musical tradition, or is it a reference to, say, the African and, you know, tradition or the blues or whatever? They wanted the arbiters of taste who ran the Metropolitan Opera and other venues like that, they wanted to keep these things strictly separate. And that's one of the things that Gershwin accomplishes is breaking that wall. And that's really one of the big focuses of his energy.
But the aristocracy did not have a monopoly on that perspective, because you tell us about the fact that Kay and George loved going to the Cotton Club. They hung out with Duke Ellington. But Duke could perform on stage, but black people were not allowed in the audience.
Yes, that's true.
So yeah, that's right. That's a different class of people, and we're talking the Roaring Twenties.
Yeah, well, you're right. And Duke Ellington is another person who definitely was, just like George Gershwin, involved in breaking down those cultural barriers. Definitely,
and they became friends.
Yes, they were friends. Absolutely.
You know, that phone call from the woman that you said from L.A. wanted to know, did that really happen, raises the question. You've written a novel, but there is so much rich stuff about people we've heard about. The Algonquin people, George and Kay were friendly. George Kaufman and Dorothy Parker and Mark Conley would just drop in, and Oscar Levant would just drop in. But you've written a novel. So how do I, as a reader, know – where does the fiction begin from the biography?
Well, but that is true. That kind of thing, you know, the fact that Kay and Jimmy were attracted to the Algonquin set and hung out with them is absolutely based on fact. I would say most of this novel is based on fact. What you do in a novel, what I like to do in a novel, is ground it very thoroughly as possible in fact, and then let the characters come alive and take me where they are supposed to go. In other words, obviously, you can't, if you're writing a book of pure history, strict history, you don't have dialogue because there was no recorded dialogue. You don't have the minds, the thoughts, the feelings of the characters. That's why history books are dry, or can be dry.
Well, the bedroom chatter, George and Kay are sharing a bedroom together.
Yeah, right.
That's not in the history book.
Right, exactly. But when you're writing a novel, in my opinion, some novelists, historical novelists, take the approach that, well, you know, this is just a novel. I can do whatever I want, you know, and these characters are interesting to me, and all that matters is their feelings. I feel their feelings matter a lot, but the context, the historical context, also matters a lot to me. So I try to make it as grounded as possible in the reality. And yet, obviously, the characters are what the book is about.
Something emerges.
To me is a big reality. Yes,
something emerges from the book. The book is titled Rhapsody. We're talking to the author, Mitchell James Kaplan. Something emerges from it that could not have been your intention. It's besides about being about Kay and George, it's also a vivid picture of what was happening in America in the 20s, in New York particularly, in that whole world of writers and artists and singers. It was post-pandemic. And are we going to have a burst of creativity? Are people so pent up? Have we been concealed so deeply that we're going to burst?
I believe that.
Do you?
I believe it with all my heart. And I actually posted on Facebook, when all this is over, we're going to have a big party. And a bunch of people chimed in and supported that idea.
So before I lose you, not that you're going to be lost like Argo's dogs. You're going to stay in Virginia. But before this interview's over, is there movie interest? And I'll tell you who I've cast.
Okay, go ahead. I'm very curious.
Well, first, is there movie interest? Because it's so ripe for the screen. I mean, it's bursting as a screen story.
Well, I had one person ask me whether the rights were available, and I said yes, and that's all I know. I have no idea, none.
Well, as Kay, I'm convinced it's Scarlett Johansson, because she was very attractive, very smart, and very hip. And that's how I see Scarlett Johansson, as a very sharp, bright, attractive woman.
She would be fantastic as Kay. We agree on that.
So, George, I saw Johansson do a View from the Bridge with Liev Schreiber. Is he George? Is he Gershwin-ish?
Maybe. I have several ideas about that.
Tell me.
He's a candidate. I agree with you.
Who do you see?
What's his name? Brodsky.
Gershwin's so complicated.
What's his name? Brodsky, his first name. I'm actually not that great with remembering actors' names, but there's a guy who's just brilliant. He was in The Pianist.
Adrian Brody?
Brody. Yeah, Adrian Brody. I don't know. He's not a big enough box office name maybe to sell the movie, but he would be amazing. He has the bearing and the look and everything.
I have a friend who did publicity, and I swear that I met Kay Swift, because he said in the 90s, she took out the house at he thinks it was Avery Fisher Hall, an evening of her songs. Did that come across you at all?
Oh, yes, I did, yes. Yeah,
and that Bobby Short, among others. And I said, I have a picture of this older, very attractive woman. She must have been in her, she must have been about 85 when she died, was she not, or older?
About that, yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm convinced I saw her, for whatever that's worth. And he said that she was of great style. That when he met her, drank a lot, but of great style.
Yeah, I think she had a certain kind of nobility about her, a kind of an awareness of herself that projected.
And she knew everyone.
She knew everyone, and she was physically attractive. Very, everyone said she was, and charming and witty. So she was an extraordinary woman and one of the inventors of the 20th century. And in a way, a forerunner.
Musically, yes, indeed. Let's tie it up, though. She George died tragically, suddenly. She divorced Warburg, and did she remarry? Did she have a life? Because we're talking late 30s when George died, and she lived till the 90s.
She did remarry, and the marriage didn't work out. She married a rodeo, you know, fucking bronco rider.
Well, that was right out of The Women. That whole scene when she gets the divorce from Warburg was, I could see the scene from The Women and from the Claire Luce play.
Yeah, it is that. But that marriage didn't work out. Culturally, they were too far apart. It was an experiment, another experiment for her. But really, George remained the love of her life. There's no question about she was always very clear about that. And, her relationship with George is the stuff of legend.
That's the movie, of course. And I'm looking at my computer, and somebody has sent in Stanley Tucci. The listeners are casting.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, too. Yeah, let's please keep casting this.
George, Hollywood make him more matinee idol, but George was not he was an average-looking, nice Jewish boy from the Upper West Side, I guess.
Yeah, and from various parts of New York. As I said, Brooklyn, Harlem.
Yeah, and the Lower East Side. Thank you for sharing. I love the book. It's
Thank
Rhapsody,
you,
the author's Mitchell James Kaplan. I await the movie. I hope people get the book. And I thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to go out with Judy Garland. But James Kaplan.
It was an honor. Thank you so much.
Oh, I enjoyed it. I could go. Maybe I'll call you after the program's over. We'll talk for another 3 hours about the movie.
And version. I will interview you because you've had an amazing life. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay.
Judy Garland, if you will.
You sons of Adam, you daughters of Eve, the time has come to take your love-torn hearts off your sleeve. Look about you. What do you see? Lovesick, lovelorn, love-wrecked, love-worn. Till this curse is wiped off from this love-mad universe. Are we mice or are we men? Can't you see the light? Come, you fellow victims, let's unite. Down with love, the flowers and rice and shoes. With love, the root of all midnight blues. Down with things that give you that well-known pain. Take that moon and wrap it in cellophane. Down with love, let's liquidate all its friends. Moon and June and roses and rainbows. Birds and the bees and the Viennese. Down with eyes, romantic and stupid. Down with sighs, down with Cupid. Brother, let's stuff that dove. Down with love, down with love, down, down, down with love.
Those are Yip Harburg lyrics, and Burton Lane wrote the music. And do you think I'd let you get away without not buying a copy of Rhapsody and supporting WBAI? We have some in-house. If you make a gift of $50 to WBAI, support us. We'll send you a copy of Mitchell James Kaplan's Rhapsody. All you have to do is email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org.
leave you a phone number, throw your address in too. That'll make it easier when I call you. And you'll get a copy of this book that is rhapsodic, if you will. I love that period. I love the period of the 20s when America was stumbling along and making changes. But I love the fact that it was the artists that were making the changes, that were leading the way, that it was George Gershwin challenging them. The Met wouldn't do Porgy and Bess. He produced it himself. They wanted to do it in blackface. Can you imagine? And he said, absolutely not. He had gone down and spent time in the Gula in South Carolina to create this epic, now classic American standard. I didn't like the first time I saw Porgy and Bess. When I finally saw it with Audra McDonald and Norman, what's his last name? Norman Lewis. I got it. They got it right that time. And I've said that, you know, the Trump era will be defined not by the historians, but by the novelists and the playwrights and the movie makers. And historically, people will look back and say, what was going on then? And when you read a book like Rhapsody, you have a sense of this is a love affair between a woman who was the first composer of Broadway musicals, wrote the music, but also had a heart and a stamina and a tenacity and involved with one of the great geniuses of our time. Rhapsody is a gem. So I invite you to email me and support BAI at the same time. God, we make generous offers to you. There's other ways you can support us. You can get my book for $25, Fortune in My Eyes. I'll autograph it for you. How's that for a big gift? You also, and we're still wearing masks, people, even though the conservative conference down in Orlando is a maskless event. The CDC urges us to continue to wear masks and get the vaccine. I got the second shot. I got it on Wednesday. Everybody told me I'd be sick on Thursday. I wasn't. I got a little sleepy at Thursday night, had a good night's sleep. I think it's the DNA of the Jews. It started with the when we were building the pyramids for the Pharaoh, we got some built-in resistance to outside nudginess. And that's why I think Jews are not, well, me, why I didn't have a reaction to the virus. But that may be, I may be going overboard on that. I have been aware of the increasing anti-Asian discrimination and physical violence that's been happening in this city and across the country. Apparently 2,000% increase. This is very similar to what Muslims were facing after 9/11. In addition to flag waving and wearing flags in the lapel, we have a history of cruelty and of other, a fear of the other. I was so appreciative of Reverend Al Sharpton joining with Asian Americans in a press conference calling to sensitize us. It's a response. Trump did it. The China virus. He did it over and over, even as when he made one of his non-concession speeches, he was still talking about the China virus. Countries, people don't create a virus. The virus creates the virus. Stupid man. And the pain of people of Asian Americans and Koreans and people, Japanese and Thailand, they're all different countries, which doesn't mean that you should attack Chinese people. It's just, I don't have the words. Let's talk about the pandemic, if you will. They've announced that some of the movies and theaters are going to open. I don't know if I'm ready to go back. I may wait a little bit. At the same time as getting the vaccine, the variants are being announced. And I don't know if the vaccines cover the variants. And I wish the mayor would stop. This is subtle. And hear me out before you get all start writhing.
De Blasio keeps saying, we're going to serve the Black and Hispanic community. It's much more accurate to say that the vaccines are going to be made available to the communities that have been hit most severely by the virus. Once you start designating that we're going to give it to African-Americans or Hispanics priority, it immediately creates an us and them situation. It's into the communities that have been the most severely struck, which happened to be, not accidentally, because historically healthcare has been systemically racist. But there has to be a smartness in selling it. There's a whole population of poor white people who end up, it's what's called horizontal hostility. They don't know that it's coming from the Trumps of the world that pit people against each other, and they strike out at the other, designated as the enemy. So if you're a West Virginia unemployed coal miner, and you're being told that priorities for the vaccine is going to African American, why them? Why not us? See, they're getting everything. No, it's going to communities much more severely struck. And if you're a poor white person in a community that's being severely struck, you will be served too. That's how it has to be sold. Oy. Smokey Robinson, get me out of all this.
Just to see her. Just to touch her. Just to hold her in my arms again. One more time. If I could feel her warm embrace. See her smiling face. Can't find anyone to take her place. I've got to see her again.
The House failed an LGBTQ legislation, but it's, the headline says the Senate prospects are bleak. It's like seeing a movie that you've already been through. 1985-86 in New York City, after years and years and years, the gay rights bill finally passed. It was legislation. It is so uncomplicated and so simple and so unthreatening. It was a civil rights bill that said because of sexual orientation, people could not be denied service at a restaurant or a hotel, fired from their job based solely on their sexual orientation, or denied housing. For years at the hearings, we were told that this would be the decline of Western civilization as we know it. And of course, Western civilization as we know it was bigoted and terrible. We wanted to fall of Western civilization as we know it. And every year the PBA would get at the city council hearings, it would be one person for the bill, one against. And it was not only gay people, but families and friends and civil rights activists who would advocate. And then after each one, somebody from the PBA, Police Benevolent Association, the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Jews, the Evangelical Catholics. In 85, I knew how we didn't win that year for civil rights, but I knew that the tide had changed. And here's how it came about. I was hanging out in my neighborhood at a local joint with a guy named Charlie Cochran. And we became friendly. And one night we were in Julius's, and some kid came running through and some cops came running after him. And I went to see, make sure that the cops didn't hurt the guy. And Charlie said, sit still. And he got up and went out and everything was straightened out. And I looked at him. I said, Charlie, you're a cop. He said, yeah, I am. And I said, and you're gay. And he said, yeah, I am. And he said, I think I'm tired of lying. I'm tired of all this. What do I do? And I said, well, let's talk about it. And then it was decided that at the next hearings on the gay rights bill, after the PBA talked about how the purity of the Western civilization would be altered, Charlie would testify. Before he did that, I invited about 8 to 10 people who had come out to meet with Charlie and tell them about the worst case scenario in their lives. So he would have an idea of what he was going, what he might be facing. And after talking with everybody for a couple of hours, he said, I can handle all that. After all, I've been a cop for 20 years. And at the next time there was the gay rights bill, up came the PBA. And then they announced the next speaker would be Sergeant Charles Cochran of the New York City Police Department. And of course, all over the house and the gay side of the, hey, they already had one. Why are they getting two in a row? And Charlie Cochran got up there and he said, my name is Charles Cochran, Sergeant, Police Department. And he started listing his honors and his medals and his awards as an outstanding New York City policeman. And he said, and I'm proud of being a cop. Big pause, Pinter pause, dramatic, as we rehearsed. And then he said, and I'm also proud of being a gay man. The room was silent. And then there was an explosion of applause from the pro-civil rights segment of the crowd. I'm standing in the back with Jenny Appuzzo, and I said, I don't know what the vote's going to be this year, but the tide has changed. It was front page in the papers the next day. It was the lead story in the evening news. And many of the channels went to his precinct and said, Charlie was not an unknown factor. And so they interviewed all these cops, and they all said, oh, that's Charlie, whatever he is, we don't care. Because he had earned his spurs. And the following year, the gay rights bill passed. Maybe Congress needs a Charlie Cochran, probably one of the kids of one of the Republicans, to come in and say, it's not so complicated. All you're doing is, that's what this, everything that we, Black Lives Matter, the Asian American confrontation. Now, what's happening to Muslims is just let us be part of the game. Let us sit at the table. You're not giving up anything. We're just having more talent. Part of them in the mix. It shouldn't be that complicated, but it is. And that's where it's all, what it's all about. And now we'll, Odetta, sing to me.
Mm-hmm. I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly across the river to the one I love. There they were, my honey, fare thee well. I woke up this morning, it was drizzling rain around my heart. Felt an ache and pain. Fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well. One of these mornings, and it won't be long, honey, I'll be gone. Fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
That's called Dirk's Blues. New York One got rid of a lot of women. I think it's an age thing. They were suing. None of the men age out on New York One. Not that they should, because I'm quite fond of a lot of them. But I miss the women that are no longer there. And I find I'm resenting the new ones, the Cupid dolls that are there. I should give them a shot. But I miss Roma Torre and some of the other young women, not young, middle, the fifth 30-ish women who left. I want to remind you that we're listener-sponsored. You can support us. $50 for the book Rhapsody. I interviewed the author, Mitchell James Kaplan. If you make a pledge of $50 to BAI, we'll send you a copy of the book. You email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org and give your phone number and I'll call you. The other book that I told you about is The Year I Flew Away. The author Marie Arnold was our guest last week. A thrilling novel about a young woman who comes from Haiti, which in fact was Marie Arnold, real name Lola St. Ville. That was her story. And why I love and urge people to get this book is to support somebody who is she's a BAI baby. She came to us as an intern a dozen years ago, worked with me on Saturday morning, answering the phone, getting theater calls. And I knew she was as bright and as sharp and as wonderful as she could be. Went to California and pops up with a book. The Year I Flew Away, the story about a Haitian girl who comes to Brooklyn and is ostracized because she's different, the other. It's a beautiful book by a beautiful young woman. It's called The Year I Flew Away, and that's available for $50 if you email me. And my book, Fortune in My Eyes, I guess everybody that listens to the program has gotten a copy of that. It's in soft cover. We'll offer it to you for $25, and I'll sign it. I'll write my name. Just email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. I'm going to tell you something startling now. For the next several months, we will not be closing with Carly Simon singing Every Time I Say Goodbye. For several weeks, I got no complaints. We were playing that song, Trump Is Gone. But I've decided I am a great admirer of Jenny Burton, whose music and her singing is as good as anybody's. And she's never had the popularity. I thought she was better than Whitney Houston, if you will. Original and beautiful and talented. And she's been on the program a few times. And so I'm going to close with a different Jenny Burton song every week until you get to know her. Maybe I'll ask her to come on and fill us in on what's happening in her life. She came to the castle one week and talked with the guys and women there. It was quite moving. And she's an interesting woman, an interesting lady. And so we'll be closing with that. So that's my news, big news. I want to remind you that we have the contest, the big contest, my once a month now contest. This one is a movie has been made, a documentary about America from Election Day to January 6th. It's all done fictionally. And they've come to me and they said, we want a title for it, but we want a WBAI sensibility to catch the people's eye. We want irony and humor and political sophistication. So that's your challenge. I gave some examples. A funny thing happened on the way to the Capitol. No time for comedy. The good, the bad, and the ugly, and the bad, and the ugly, and the bad, and the ugly, and the ugly. You can make three selections. You send it to me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. I want your name, full name, first and last, and where you live, not your address, borough, city, whatever. So when we announce that you have swept to the great heights with absolutely no reward for winning, other than being part of the fun that we're having. So support us, email me and get one of our books and support BAI, or just say I want to contribute $25 because I like the station. Jenny Burton, the song we're going to start off with today is On Broken Pieces. That'll be our closing number for today. And I'm on Monday at 10 and next Saturday at 8 a.m., and we'll close every Saturday with a different Jenny Burton song. Take it away, Miss Burton.
Mm-hmm. everything went my way once upon a time.
Once it was all so fine.
Then nothing was good enough when I had it all. Stuffed full of this empty stuff, I began to fall. When all of it shattered, I searched through the ruins of my life, though broken and battered. At last I found a way. Now I can make it, I can make it.
WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You just heard Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. After a little station business, you'll hear On the Count at 10 a.m. Please stay tuned.
Wash your hands, everybody, and everybody. Wash your hands. My people uptown, wash your hands. My people downtown, wash your hands. People from the East Coast, wash your hands. People from the West Coast, wash your hands.
That's right. First and foremost, please listen close. Take your time, wash. Use a lot of soap from the front to the back. Back to the front. Sing the hook where you at. That's exactly what we want. You catch a little fever. Shortness of breath. Slight little cough. You feel it in your chest. You should call your doctor. Doctor know what's best. Don't go running to the hospital because you could be a threat. Coronavirus.
Don't you get it?
Epidemic.
Pandemic.
Social distance. Non-existence. Don't resist this. Get gone in an instance. If you miss this.
Extinction Diaries. A 2019 study shocked the world with the data that the world's plants are going extinct about 300 to 500 times faster than expected. In Hawaii alone, 79 plant species have gone extinct in the last 120 years. There are more than 300,000 known species of plants, and of those, only around 13,000 have been evaluated. Of those 13,000, 68% are threatened with extinction. While this data is startling, the rate of plant extinctions is actually less than that of animals, which are disappearing 1,000 times or more faster than before humans began destroying and degrading the planet's resources. However, biologists are warning that many plant species are going extinct before they are even discovered. All in all, the planet's plant extinction rate remains a significant and dire warning to humanity. Species of trees that are far more resilient than man are disappearing forever. My name is Arnold Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
This station is so significant for me. I remember the days that we were fighting against the overuse of stop and frisk. No other station would cover the conversation and inform the listeners.
Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams.
The acronym for WBAI is where badass insurgents learn how to get their information out in a clear way. This station must survive. connect the dots. There's a movement to destroy independent communications across this entire country, and this has become ground zero. We must do all that we must do. Roll up our sleeves, put Vaseline on our face, take our heels off, get into a deep fight, because we're about to fight to keep this station alive. Whose station? Our station.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 19. 19-